Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism.
The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we inject weird and wonderful science directly into your brain. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this edition, life, the universe, and carnivorous plants. But first up, here's the news. Plants that eat help you eat wheat. A collaboration of researchers from the University of Calgary in Canada and Graz University of Technology in Austria have extracted enzymes from the digestive fluids of the traps of carnivorous tropical pitcher plants that will lead to a pill that allows people with celiac disease to digest gluten in foods that would otherwise make them sick. About 1% of the population suffer from celiac disease and have an abnormal immune response after eating foods that contain gluten proteins from wheat, rye, and barley. In people born with a genetic predisposition to the illness, their bodies produce antibodies to the gluten that also attack their own internal organs, particularly the small intestine. People may suffer symptoms of abdominal pain and bloating to chronic diarrhea, fatigue, and weight loss, although some people don't show any obvious symptoms. There is currently no cure, and a gluten-avoiding diet is the only treatment. It can be very difficult to avoid all gluten, as some people are sensitive to even the smallest amounts that could be left over from food preparation. Nepenthes are a species of carnivorous plants that grow in tropical countries that lure insects to them with colour and nectar. The insects then slip on waxy surfaces that become progressively more slippery and fall to be trapped into a deep cup or pitcher-shaped leaf. The plant digests the insects in a special digestive fluid in the trap, like a plant's stomach. The fluid is protected from being diluted by rain by a leafy roof. Some types of Nepenthes grow large enough to catch rats. Some types of Nepenthes have formed symbiotic relationships with bats to provide them with food and shelter in return for their droppings. Some Nepenthes can digest leaves that fall into their traps, as well as insects. Nepenthes, like other carnivorous plants, evolved the ability to catch and digest insects and sometimes other things because they grow in soil that's poor in nutrients like phosphorus, nitrogen, and minerals. The giant Nepenthes rafflesiana plants used in the first part of this study are native to Malaysia, Borneo, Sumatra, and Singapore. The team grew the plants in a terrarium and fed each of the traps a fruit fly the day before they harvested the traps. After allowing the traps to digest the flies, they emptied the fluid and ground up the bottom third of the traps where the enzyme secretion glands grow. They then extracted the RNA of this part of the plant. The RNA was put through reverse transcription to generate the complementary DNA. This allowed them to filter out DNA from bacteria and fruit flies to be able to find out which proteins the DNA could make. This gave them the protein content of the digestive fluid that Nepenthes rafflesiana traps contain. They next took 100 Nepenthes ventrata plants and grew them the same way, and fed each of the traps one fruit fly. Nepenthes ventrata is native to the Philippines. The digestive fluid from 1,000 pitcher traps were pooled together after a week digesting flies and filtered to remove the bodies of the dead flies and other debris. They analysed the fluid using mass spectrometry, a method of electrically charging the compounds and sorting them based on their mass-to-charge ratio to identify them. This gave them the proteins contained in the Nepenthes ventrata traps digestive fluid. Examining the digestive solution from the traps of these Nepenthes plants, they found a set of enzymes that can break down gluten into safer compounds in a way that can be transferred to the human stomach. The team found the enzymes nepenthicin and nepricin that can break up toxic food peptides into smaller, non-toxic ones. Nepricin was previously unknown to science. They've established that the plant's enzymes can actually digest a significant amount of gluten under conditions that will work in a human stomach, while also proving in animal models that this can reduce inflammation. The team plan to develop the discovery into an enzyme supplement pill that will help people with celiac disease to digest gluten before it causes any problems in their small intestine. As well as celiac disease, the Nepenthes enzyme pill could also help with other illnesses such as dermatitis herpetiformis, a chronic skin blistering condition, and pancreatic enzyme deficiency, where your pancreas doesn't produce enough digestive enzymes for you to absorb all the nutrients in your food. In some countries, Nepenthes are called monkey cups. Maybe the monkeys are onto a good thing. The study was published in the Journal of Proteome Research and titled Carnivorous Nutrition in Pitcher Plants, Nepenthes Species, via an unusual complement of endogenous enzymes. You're listening to Ian Wolfe on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com. Mark Colavan is Professor of Philosophy at the University of Sydney, where he gave a public talk in response to Luke Barnes about the fine-tuning of the universe's physical constants for life. After speaking to Luke a few weeks ago, I visited Mark in his office and began by asking him, is it remarkable that the universe seems finely tuned to produce the chemistry that allows life to develop?
It turns out there's a whole bunch of really interesting physical constants that had to be just right in order to get something, a universe as complicated as one with carbon in it. And of course you need carbon for carbon-based life at least. And these constants seem to be just as they need to be. They could be in a little different, but not very much. And this has sort of led people to wonder why these constants are as they are.
And the fact that the universe is just right for life, or life is just right for the universe, does that mean there's something special about this? Or is the question is, does it mean anything that we're here to observe the universe and that the alternatives probably can't have life?
Good question. I mean, so the first thing is to wonder whether there's anything special that actually is in need of explanation. So as you suggested, one of the things to sort of say is, well, what a universe without, if the constants were different, then there would be no life. But there'd be no one sitting around wondering, oh, I wonder why there's no life in this universe. There'd be no one there to do that. So you're only going to get people wondering, or organisms wondering about what's going on in those universes with life. So there's a kind of a selection effect for the life-containing universes. In fact, for the consciousness-containing universes, even sort of finer still, as it were. But the first question is whether you really need, there's anything there to explain in the first place. You might think, well, the constants had to be just thus and so in order to get a universe with life in it. But they had to be thus and so for all sorts of other things as well. And the constants had to be some value or other. So there's various points you can wonder about how this argument goes. One is to say, well, they're fine-tuned, but does that mean that it's improbable, that this universe is improbable? Because the usual story is, if something's improbable, then you might need to explain it. If I'm playing cards with you and I keep getting royal flush after royal flush and I'm dealing, you're quite right to think, well, that's pretty improbable. I'd like to know what's going on here. And, the default hypothesis is I'm cheating, right? But notice what's going on there is first that the hands I'm getting are improbable and there's something significant about them. Royal flushes beat you and I take your money, right, if we're playing for money. Whereas if I just get one hand and then a different hand and another hand and they're all terrible, they're all equally improbable. You know, a particular terrible hand is really improbable as well. So you wouldn't say, for instance, we're playing cards and I keep dealing sort of bad hands to myself. You think, wow, that's really improbable. That requires explanation. You're inclined to think, well, that's, you'd have to be some hand or other. So that's the first thing to worry about in this argument, is whether the fine-tuning actually leads to an improbability claim that you need, that is requiring explanation. And then, is there something special that, you know, just like the winning hand, for instance, you know? And of course, people tend to think there's something special about life because we're, you know, we're part of that. But that's, they're kind of two steps in the argument, I think, that you need to sort of think carefully about whether you get the probability, improbability claim rather, and whether there's something special about the improbable state we find ourselves in, if it is indeed improbable.
Is one explanation, is anybody considering that perhaps this is the only values that could be taken, that there's something inherent in the way the universe works, that these are the only values that of the constants that there could be, that something determines them to be one value and not another?
I don't know that anyone thinks they had to be exactly as they are. It's certainly the modelling that various astronomers have been doing show that the values could have been slightly different and still get the production of carbon in the universe. The question is, how different could they be? And what the modelling seems to show is they could have been a little different, but not very much. Almost any other value would have given a very different looking universe. And the sort of default assumption in there is that there's nothing kind of fixing them to be exactly what they are. But maybe you're right. Maybe there is something sort of deeper in the physics that says, no, they just really had to be this value. Or rather, they had to be in some narrow window. They could have been some other different values, but maybe not too different from this. And then there wouldn't be anything terribly surprising. But the thought, I think, that most astronomers who look at this are concerned with is that they could have been different, but and the range over which they could have been different is much larger than the range which we need to get life. So there's that thought that so it's kind of like hitting a bullseye on a dartboard. It's a small little area compared to the whole dartboard, and you tend to think I could have hit. I'm not so bad that I would have missed the dartboard completely, but randomly throwing a dart at a dartboard, the chance of hitting the bullseye is rather small because it's a small little target in a larger area. But you've got to be careful there, because if it turns out that, no, I couldn't have hit the whole dartboard, the dart was always going to hit the bullseye, then there's nothing much to explain. On the other hand, if I had the whole world to choose from, I'm no guarantee of hitting the dartboard, then in a sense the bullseye is smaller still compared to the whole wall, right? But so's the dartboard, you know, and so the sense in which it becomes improbable is harder to pin down. There's some sort of technical details in the probability theory that we won't need to go into, but the getting that probability claim just right requires something like the interval for life-supporting universes is small compared to some larger interval, which has to be delineated. It can't be just any value.
So if it's not just random chance, if something is biasing the universe towards values that allows complex chemistry and life, what would be the things that would make that happen?
Right, so let's suppose we agree to the fact that it's not just fine-tuned, but it's improbable, and that there's something there to explain. It's not like just any old random card hand we've been dealt. It's something special about the card hand. And arguably, you can make the case that there's something special about consciousness, at least. And then you ask the question, how did we end up in this sort of state of affairs? The two kind of prime hypotheses here are that we've had lots of shots at it, in a way. So if I have a royal flush, you might think, wow, that's really improbable. But if I've been dealing hand after hand after hand, and then I just stop when I get to the royal flush, that's kind of less surprising, right? Because one's got to come up every now and again. So the thought is that if you've had lots of shots at the universe, either kind of, it's hard to put this in terms of time or space, but the multi-universe or multiverse hypothesis is that there are just lots of universes. And some of them have life in them, not many, and most of them don't. But in those where there is life, there's people like us sitting around talking about it and wondering why that's so. And it's less surprising on the hypothesis that there are lots of universes out there that this one's got life, because some of them had to have life, you know. So that's one hypothesis which it gets a lot of discussion. Another that gets a lot of discussion, which I personally have less sympathy for, is that there was a designer. It was kind of, it's a setup job, if you like. You know, the values had to be hand-picked, and they were kind of literally hand-picked by some designer. And, you know, you can see where that line of reasoning goes. It's often called this intelligent design hypothesis. But again, you need a lot of extra baggage there. For instance, you've got to have some story about why the designer likes life, for a start. Why would they like life like us? I mean, surely, you know, you could, lots of all the kinds of life you could have, you might think you could end up with something better designed than humans, for instance, but that's another story. There's two main hypotheses. One is that there's a designer, and the other is that we've had lots of shots at it.
Of course, if there was a designer, there'd have to be a way for the designer to manufacture the universe. There'd have to be a way to set the constants going.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's usually underexplored in this sort of line of thought. But, you know, if you've got an all-powerful deity, then presumably that's the kind of bread and butter stuff for all in powerful deity. But I'm in no position to sort of read the minds or the abilities of such things.
And the multiverses, is it connected to the multiverses that quantum physicists talk about?
There are similarities, but they're not exactly the same. I mean, the reason you're positing this bunch of multiverses, that they're kind of running in their entirety in order to explain improbable events in this universe, whereas the quantum mechanics multiverses, and I should say I'm no expert on this, but my understanding is that you've got these kind of collapsing at various sort of crucial observations. So it's a more of a kind of branching structure, whereas this is, you know, they're all running in parallel. So they're similar in some ways, in that all possibilities are kind of realized somewhere, you know, but this is very particular about the kinds of possibilities we're interested in are the possible values of the constants. Is you're not so interested in, you know, all sorts of other things that might have happened. So, for instance, philosophers entertain many possible worlds to understand probability theory and counterfactuals. You know, I might have worn different shoes today. That's true. Not because I did wear different shoes. I wore the shoes that I did, but I might have worn others. That's true. What makes that true is, according to this particular story, there is a possible world in which I do wear some other shoes, right? And so this sort of structure, you need a possible world for every way things might have been, as it were. Whereas this particular multiverse view, what you require is a different universe for every value that the constant might have taken. So there are subtle differences in this and the philosopher's use of possible worlds and quantum mechanics appeal to wheeler worlds, as they're called.
And so what do you think is the most reasonable solution to the question of the, I think there's, so you've mentioned that either it's not meaningful that there's life particularly, or it is meaningful that there's life, but it could be a multiverse or it could be an intelligent designer. That's the main three explanations?
Yeah, and in the first, there's also the question of whether there's anything improbable to start with. So I've gone into print suggesting that it's really, really difficult at least to get the improbability claim. To get, I grant the evidence, the fine-tuning that seems undeniable, that you've got a fine-tuned universe. And that's interesting. There's a lot of sort of, a great deal of sort of scientific interest in that alone. But then to get to from there to that it's improbable, I think there are huge sort of technical difficulties in that step. But let's set that aside. Let's suppose you think that is improbable. Then the further question of whether you think that needs explaining. You know, is it just like it had to be some card hand or other, or is there something special about this one that requires explaining? I am tempted sometimes to sort of dig my heels in there and think, you know, the values had to be something or other. Why should we wondering about the ones that just give rise to life. We think there's something special about life, but what we require is that something's objectively special about life, not just it's special to us because we're alive. It's like thinking, you know, you meet someone in a bar somewhere and you think, wow, they're an Australian, that's amazing, you know. And the other side of the world, I've met an Australian in a bar, and you think, nothing so special about that except for the fact that I am Australian. And there's a, so it, there's a, you need to be careful that you're not just sort of reading off stuff that seems special to you because of who you are and where you're located. So I'm kind of tempted by that. But were you to sort of get past that point and think, okay, now there is something that requires explanation, then I'm inclined to think that the multiverse is a good and interesting explanation. It also raises, I think, fascinating questions about how you would verify that hypothesis. Because normally what you do in science, right, is you say, I've got something that needs explaining, I advance a hypothesis for that explanatory task, and now I need to test that hypothesis and see whether that's in fact the way things are. And usually that's done by testing. You sort of think of a way of isolating that particular hypothesis and then running some experiment or some observational work or whatever, but you need to sort of somehow or other test that hypothesis. That's sort of one of the things that physicists and astronomers worry about with the multiverse is, how do you test it? We're in this one. We don't have access to the other ones. And so it looks like some speculative metaphysics. Various scientists have said this. It looks like it's not a scientific hypothesis. I don't hold that view. I think all things being equal, you'd like to test scientific hypotheses. But there are other ways of testing. You might think the way they cohere with other scientific theories is a kind of indirect test, for instance. But there are interesting, very interesting questions around this hypothesis about how would you confirm it? How does it sit with other hypotheses? You raise the question about the multiverse view that you get from quantum mechanics. What is the relationship between those? There's lots of ways of sort of thinking about this and how you might confirm the multiverse hypothesis. I have my reservations usually early on in the argument, but I think if you kind of push me past those reservations, I think the multiverse is an intriguing scientific hypothesis and great fun to think about.
Well, Mark Colvin, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
That was Mark Colvin, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Sydney, talking about the fine-tuning of the universe for life and what it might mean. Next up, They Might Be Giants with Science is Real.
Science is real, from the Big Bang to DNA. Science is real, from evolution to the Milky Way. I like those stories about angels, unicorns, and elves. Now I like those stories as much as anybody else, but when I'm seeking knowledge, either simple or abstract, the facts are with science.
That was They Might Be Giants with Science is Real. You can hear more at theymightbegiants.com. And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Would you like to hear your voice on radio? We need more people contributing stories to Diffusion. Send your contributions, opinions, congratulations, helpful suggestions, and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. And please do send me an email so I know you're listening and you'd like to hear more episodes. Please like the Diffusion Science Radio page on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter at Ian Wolfe. Please look at the Patreon page at patreon.com/diffusionradio. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia on the Community Radio Network, including 8CCC in Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, 2NVR in Nambucca Valley, and 3MBR in the Mallee Border districts of Victoria and South Australia. Diffusion is syndicated globally on the National Science Foundation's Science 360 internet radio station and also on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to our podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com, and check the website for links, photos and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed the show, then you can explore more than 850 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Subscribe to the Diffusion YouTube channel at youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. I'm Ian Wolfe. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the Earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography. Collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.